Okay, good evening. I'm back from my sojourn to New York. We met 2 weeks ago from the airport. I'm going to continue a little bit where I left off. I know that you had a session with Dr. Finkelman that was kind of parenthetical and doesn't really fit into the flow of the specific topics that we're talking about, but I hope was relevant generally to our study of Jewish history. If you have a video camera, please hit the send video button. And let me just check to see who's online with us. Alan, Chaim, Joel, Sherry, Tilalea, Yair. Okay. I wanted to talk tonight about the events of 1648, also known as the Gzerot Tach V'tat. The Gzerot, we very often think of Gzerot as like rabbinic enactments. That's not what the word here means at all. Here, gzerot, like in the sense of gzera ra'ah, of an evil decree. The evil decrees of 1648 and 1649. Just parenthetically, I want to make this note, which may be well known to some of you, but it's a handy tool to have under your belt, both as somebody interested in history, as well as anybody that's interested in Jewish life. The simple formula for figuring out dates. We of course go by the Minyan Lebriat Ha'olam. Our dates, the Hebrew dates, go according to counting from the creation of the world, which in Latin is called AM, not to be confused with the morning hours, but AM as opposed to CE, what we call the Common Era, or in the Christian world they call AD, the years after zero. We call AM Anno Mundi, the years of the world. So that right now, in the year Tufshin Ayin, we are right now in the year Tufshin Ayin, which is 5770 in the Jewish calendar. How do you calculate these dates? It's a little confusing. It's a little bit confusing. Tufshin Ayin, for example, the year that we're in now, so the gematria of those numbers, Tuf equals 400, Shin equals 300, Ayin equals 70, and that brings us to the year 770. 770, having no connection at all to Chabad. No offense to anybody with Chabad connections. We're in the year 770. So where do you get the five in the thousandths place from? Where does that come in to the year Tufshin Ayin? It doesn't really. Hebrew gematria has no elegant or simple way to represent the thousands. I trust that you all know how the gematria system works. If you don't, email me and I'll spend 5 minutes with you afterwards, and I'll explain that. But the highest value number for any one letter is 400. The letter Taf has the equivalent of 400. So there's no real easy way to represent numbers bigger than 400 without adding Taf. The number 1,000 in gematria would be Taf Resh. 400 plus 400 plus 200 equals 1,000. So that gets unwieldy. So what we do is we represent the numbers minus the 1,000 column. So that when we say that the year is Tufshin Ayin, what we're really saying is it's the year 770. And you just have to know to add on the thousands. Sometimes you'll see, like you have here, sometimes you'll see the year is written out with the letter Hey, and that apostrophe, or what it's colloquially known in Hebrew as the chipchuk, or the chupchik, to kind of just indicate that they're the hey equaling five, and the chipchuk indicating that it's not part of the normal counting, just to kind of shorthand 5,000. But generally, that's left off. What you need to know is that the year 5,000, the year that began the thousand-year period that we're currently in, corresponds to the year 1240. So all you need to do translate dates from the Hebrew date to the Common Era date, as long as you're dealing with a date that's after the year 1240, which is, you know, most of the dates that we're dealing with, is to know that the year 5000 was equivalent to the year 1240 CE. So you do the gematria of the year, it gives you 770, you add 1240, and that's how you know that you're in the year 5770. It's important to remember, of course, that the secular date and the Hebrew date, the years only overlap for about 9 or 10 of the months, so that the year 5770, which equals 2010, the year 5770 actually began on Rosh Hashanah 2009, sometime back in the end of September. So sometimes it's actually in 2009, but mostly it's in 2010. The year 5000 was mostly in the year 1240, but it began in the year 1239. We're talking now about the Gzerot Tach V'Tat. Tach is a representation of a year. Tach, this is easier. Tach, the gematria of Tach, Taf Chet, is 408, plus our magic formula number of 1240 gives you 1648. So Gzerot Tach V'Tat were these persecutions that took place in Eastern Europe in the middle of the 17th century, specifically starting in 1648. They actually lasted for more than 2 years, and they ushered in a period of time that went on for quite a while, but generally speaking, this is how they're referred to, as the Gzerot, sometimes just the Gzerot Tach, sometimes as the Gzerot Tach V'Tat. The Gzerot Tach V'Tat, just by a quick show of hands, how many people are familiar with this event in Jewish history, the Gzerot Tach V'Tat? Okay. So I'm not surprised that it's not unanimous. But what's surprising is, I mean, we'll see that the Gzerot Tach V'Tat, these persecutions, these pogroms that took place throughout Eastern Europe, the Ukraine and Poland specifically, were the most devastating persecution of Jews in history from the time of Churban HaBayit, the destruction of the temple, until the Holocaust. And the gravity and the uniqueness of the Shoah, of course, overshadows everything. But the Gzerot Tach V'Tat were a tragedy of epic proportions, as we'll see. The Gzerot Tach V'Tat in 1648 and 1649 were headed by, or led by, or associated by with this figure here, Bogdan Khmelnytsky, who lived from 1595 to 1657. He was a Cossack. We've all heard about the Cossacks. We may have heard our grandmothers or our great grandmothers talk about the Cossacks, the evil Cossacks. Hold on 1 second. The Cossacks, it's important to note there about this, there's also a misunderstanding. The Cossacks were not, it's not an ethnic group per se. The Cossacks were an Eastern European military organization. It was like being part of an organization, maybe like being part of the mafia, or we'd think of it that way. I guess if we were here studying Ukrainian history, we might have a different orientation to it. And what's interesting is that this character, Khmelnytsky, he's known sometimes just as Khmil in Jewish chronicles. in the Ukraine is he's like their George Washington. He's like the father of the modern Ukrainian nation. It's a little anachronistic to talk about the Ukraine as a nation because it doesn't really exist that way in the time period that we're talking about. But I use that just so you should understand where it is that we're talking about. If you're interested in this topic, just probably look up the article on Ukraine in the Wikipedia, or if you happen to have an old-fashioned encyclopedia, that will do the trick. In Kiev, the capital of Ukraine, there's this huge statue of Khmelnytsky on horseback, because he united the Ukrainian Cossacks, and fought basically a war of revolution against Poland, who had been controlling the area. And liberated that land from Polish rule. But we know him as the head of a mass murdering organization that, in the process of fighting this war of liberation from against Poland, and then later tensions with Russia. And ultimately a kind of truce with Russia. We kind of got caught in the middle, which is very often the story of the Jews in Europe. It's very similar to what happened to us during the Crusades. In the early Middle Ages, the Crusades are preached in Western Europe. The Christians march across Europe to the Holy Land to liberate it from the infidel Muslims, and along the way they make it a point of killing lots of Jews, and that's part of what happens here in this war that didn't really involve us per se. The Cossacks and the peasants made a strong military force. This was partially fueled by religious tensions, having nothing to do with us. The Cossacks were Greek Orthodox, and the ruling Polish class were Roman Catholic, and that was also part of the tension. The Cossacks, led by Khmelnytsky, invade Poland. They capture territory, and ultimately there's a truce between them, which is never really honored by either side. So this fighting goes on for a number of years, and in the process, many, many Jews are killed. Many communities are destroyed. Now, in the Jewish chronicles, the chronicles that are written at the time and shortly after the events. As well as in chronicles that are written subsequently, there are numbers that are given about how many Jews are killed, and it ranges anywhere from 100,000 to 500,000 Jews killed in the process of these pogroms and these wars. 500,000 seems to clearly be a gross exaggeration. The truth probably lies somewhere in the middle. There's an interesting article that I read recently by Shaul Stampfer, who's a professor of history at the Hebrew University. A very, very fine professor of history, where he does some of the demographic work, trying to figure out altogether how do we know even how many Jews there were in the 17th century, and how do we know how many people were killed? There weren't censuses per se, and he does some of that interesting type of work, which is really the kishkes of doing history. This was an article that appeared. There's a journal. The journal itself is called Jewish History. It appeared in volume 17, which was published in 2003. If anybody's interested, you can email me, and I think I can send it to you. The article is entitled "What Actually Happened to the Jews of Ukraine in 1648," and there he deals with some of these questions of how do we figure out how many people actually died, or how do we even figure out how many Jews lived in a particular region at a particular time in the pre-modern, in the pre-modern era, he actually comes in with a much, much, much lower estimate of how many people were killed. But that doesn't seem to be what's so significant. The necessity of counting numbers, and this is, of course, something that we know about because we're very much hooked into the talisman, the symbolism of the number 6 million, which is, of course, I assume, a number that resonates for all of us. The magnitude of the Holocaust was not that 6 million Jews were killed, although that, of course, is an unimaginable fact. The magnitude of the Holocaust was the idea that one nation thought that they could extinguish another nation, and that they marshaled the technology and the resources of hold on one second, I'm looking at the chats. Marshaled the resources of what was one of the most developed cultured nations in the world up to that point towards genocide. The fact that they, pardon the expression, I'm saying in quotes, succeeded in killing 6 million Jews, it would have been less horrific had only 5 million Jews been killed by a factor of 1/6, if you look at it from the human perspective. But from the significance of what happened is irrelevant. In other words, even had they only killed one Jew, the evil of what they purported to do was just unprecedented. The fact that they killed 6 million means that you have an infinite tragedy, the death of a human being, multiplied by 6 million, so you have infinity times 6 million. So partially, the whole discussion of numbers, while important, of course, and the work of what history does, need not overshadow the larger question of what was going on here. So whether it was 100,000 Jews were killed or 200,000 Jews were killed, what was significant was the impact that these events had on Jewish life in that period and the aftermath. There was some question about the gematria before. Let me just go back for a second. Right. Okay. According to some Jewish chronicles, beyond the people that were outright killed in a really gory way, there was also a lot of chaos and famine and disease. There's discussion of 300 Jewish communities destroyed. At the time, in the mid-17th century, the world Jewish population, the best estimates we have, was probably around 3.5 million Jews. In Eastern Europe, there were probably 1.3 million Jews. So if even only 100,000 are killed, and that's the lower number of the estimates that are given, that's a very, very, very significant portion of the of the indigenous Eastern European population. Yeah, I mean, Tehillalea makes this point that that Rome or Greece or Babylon in their days were the most advanced civilizations of their time. The innovation of the Holocaust was, a whole modern state, and there are differences. We're not really discussing the Holocaust at the moment, so I'm not going to go into that. But that's true. It's also true that none of those nations before set out to extinguish the Jewish people. Although Jews were killed in large numbers along the way, the agenda of Rome or Greece or Babel was not to murder everyone. The Purim story perhaps being an exception to this. These chronicles that we have, these stories, I sent out to you a copy earlier in the week. I don't know if anybody had a chance to look it over. If you do me a favor, just raise your hand if you had a chance to read over these few pages from the Evan Mitsula. Okay. So the Evan Mitsula is a contemporary chronicle written by Nata Hanover. Ashkenazi was probably his last name. And he writes this book called the Yevon Mitsula, the Pits of Despair, the Abyss of Despair. This is an English translation of a few passages from this really interesting book, a very, very big fat book called The Literature of Destruction, Jewish Responses to Catastrophe, which is an anthology of throughout history from Eicha until the Holocaust. Everything that's been written by people trying to document Jewish tragedy and Jewish destruction. And he tells the story of what happened during this period. It's written in a style which is meant to echo Eicha, the way that Eicha, the Book of Lamentations, what we read on Tisha B'Av, recounts in rather gory detail, but also a very somber poetry, a lamentation, the story of Tisha B'Av. So here the author of the Evan Mitsula echoes the style of Eicha, echoes the style of the Tochacha, and he writes here in the beginning, "I am the man that's seen the affliction by the rod of his wrath." These are psukim. He's quoting from Eicha. When God smote his people Israel, his firstborn, from heaven unto earth, he cast down the beautiful and glorious land of Poland. In other words, it's taking, what Yirmiyahu writes in Eicha about Eretz Yisrael, here he's talking about Poland, and this reminds us of that fable that we saw a few weeks ago from Agnon, or that fable that predates Agnon, which he records about the Jews arriving in Poland. So here, Poland is replaced for Eretz Yisrael. "O fair in situation, the joy of the whole earth, the Lord has swallowed up unsparingly the habitations of Yaakov." These are all quotes from Psukim, from Eicha, from Tilim, from the Tochacha. "The lot of his inheritance, and has not remembered his footstool in the day of his anger." So the whole pogrom, like Eicha, is cast, like Churban HaBayit, is cast in the mold of some kind of divine punishment, that if Eastern European Jewry is being persecuted, it's obviously an indication that God is angry with us, that God is angry with us. And then there's certain motifs that repeat in the next passage, about the destruction of the city of Nemirov in 1648. In 1648, on the 20th of Sivan, which is, you know, shortly after Shavuot in June, there was a concentration of murder in the city of Nemirov. Let me see, what are the numbers here? Six thousand Jews were massacred in Nemirov on one day or on 2 days. As a matter of fact, the Vad Arba Artsot, which we talked about last time, the kind of the governing council of Eastern Europe, declares the 20th of Sivan a fast day, and it's observed as a fast day for centuries. In some places, it's observed even up until the Holocaust. Again, after the Holocaust, it's overshadowed. And now we don't really encounter people who fast on the 20th of Sivan. But the 20th of Sivan was observed by Eastern European Jews and the descendants of Eastern European Jews as a fast day, and they had slichot, and they had the special tfilot, special prayers that they recited on this day to commemorate, to mark an observance of the particularly worst day of this series of pogroms, is the 20th of Sivan, 1648, in the city of Nemirov. And here in the Yevon Metzula, he describes it. He tells the following story. He says that the oppressor Chmiel, this is Chmielnitsky, may his name be blotted out, heard that many Jews had gathered in the holy community of Nemirov, and that they had a great deal of silver and gold with them. He knew that the holy community of Nemirov was distinguished for its great riches. It had been a great and important community, replete with scholars and scribes, a city of justice and abode of righteousness. Right? In other words, again, he's echoing certain biblical themes. Accordingly, Chmiel sent a leader, an enemy of the Jews, and about 600 swordsmen with him to attack the noble community. And this is an idea. This is an idea that we see in these kind of chronicles, that the Jews are fortressed up in some kind of guarded city. The Cossacks get in either by force or by trickery, and some kind of Trojan horse technique or some other way, disguising themselves as the Poles, who at this point the Jews think are coming to rescue them. The head of the rabbinical academy in Nemirov was also there. His name was His Excellency, our master and teacher, the Rabbi Rabbi Yechiel Michel, son of His Excellency Rabbi Eliezer of blessed memory. He knew the whole of rabbinic writings by heart and was proficient in all the worldly sciences. On the Shabbat before the catastrophe, he had preached and admonished the people that if the enemy should come, God forbid, they should not change their faith, but rather be martyred for the sanctification of his name, Al Kiddush Hashem. This the holy people did. He also jumped into the water, believing that he would save himself by swimming when a Ukrainian seized him and wanted to slay him. But this scholar implored him not to kill him, for which he would compensate him with a great deal of gold and silver. The Ukrainian consented and led him to the house where his silver and gold were hidden, and the Cossack released him. The rabbi then left the place with his mother, and the two hid in a certain house all night till the morning dawn. The next day, the 22nd of Sivan, the Ukrainians searched the houses, suspecting that Jews might be hidden there. The rabbi and his mother then fled to the cemetery. Thus, should they be killed, they would receive burial. Although it's not clear to me if they're killed by the Ukrainians in the cemetery, who's going to bury them. But I guess at least they'll be in the cemetery. But it so happened that when they came near the cemetery, a Ukrainian shoemaker, here another theme, who gets them in the end? It's the shoemaker, right? A simple peasant, right? This reminds us of, you know, that book of a few years ago, Hitler's Willing Executioners, that what was as horrendous as the entire state being put to use to the destruction of the Jews, at great cost, by the way, while Nazi Germany is busy fighting a war on two fronts, they dedicate a third front to fight this war against the Jews instead of fighting against the Allied forces. And Hitler's able to do this because his willing executioners, you know, the Polish, I mean, to say not, you know, we must, of course, recognize the righteous Gentiles, you know, many of whom at great risk to their own life, you know, saved Jews. But the reality is that there were many willing executioners, the simple shoemakers, the milkmen and the peddlers and the peasants who were willing to do in the 17th century Khmelnytsky's work and in the 20th century Hitler's work. A Ukrainian shoemaker, one of the townspeople, pursued the rabbi with club in hand and inflicted on him wounds. The rabbi's mother pleaded with the Ukrainian to kill her instead of the son, but the latter paid no attention and proceeded to kill first the rabbi and then the mother. May God avenge their blood. 3 days after the massacre, the rabbi's wife buried him, for in the town where the slaughter took place, the majority of the women were spared, except for the old and feeble, who were killed. And then it tells a few other such stories of martyrdom. So what's interesting, I mean, as horrific and as moving as this description is, if you think objectively for a second, if you think historically for a second, what's interesting about this story? Anybody, is there anything that sticks out about this story? Yeah, the details. Right? Oh, so Tehillah, of course, that's correct, that not to deny your Jewishness in order to save your life, to die al Kiddush Hashem. But how do we know this? How do we know? Now, there's this story of the rabbi and his mother being killed by the shoemaker in the cemetery. Who escaped to tell the story? Right? In other words, that there was this figure, Rabbi Yechiel Michel ben Eliezer, who was the rabbi of Nemirov, and that he was killed, and that his mother was killed. So that, we can assume, is a historical fact. But the color commentary, the details, that they were in the cemetery, that the mother said, please kill me and spare my son. And again, this is an adult son at this point. It's not a child. Kill me to spare my son. How do we know these details? Who reported these details? Surely not the shoemaker. How do we know it was a shoemaker? There's a certain, these chronicles are not written, and we call them chronicles. They're not history books. Right, well, Chaim asks this question, where was the wife? I mean, it doesn't say. We don't know where the wife was. Apparently, she wasn't left behind in the house when he and his mother escaped. Apparently, I don't know, we can imagine that she had been in safekeeping or in hiding someplace else. We simply don't know. It doesn't tell us. But some of these details are probably, shall we say, agadic in nature. They're there to round out, to flesh out a picture, but it shouldn't be read as history in the kind of objective, factual, black on white way that we tend to now think of history. They're here to represent a certain point of view. They're here to be exhortatory in nature. They're meant to inspire the survivors to do what? The author of this work, what is he trying to get his readers to do? Right, to hate the Cossacks. Well, probably you don't need to encourage people to hate. You don't need to write a book to encourage Jews to hate Cossacks at this point. That's not necessary. But to not to despair, to remember what happened, which is this ever-present Jewish imperative, Zachor, to remember what happened. There's an excellent, excellent, excellent work called Zachor, Z-A-K-H-O-R, by Professor Yerushalmi, who just passed away a couple of weeks ago. Really one of the best works on the whole entirety of Jewish history. It's a slim little volume about this imperative to remember, which becomes the leitmotif of all of Jewish historical consciousness. It's not translated into English. It was written in English, even though the title is Zachor. Let me just put up the. It's called Z A K H O R, and it's by Yosef Yerushalmi. I'm certain you can get it in on Amazon.com and probably in many Jewish bookstores. And he discusses the question of the imperative to remember. He's also probably trying to encourage people. This is written in the shortly after the events, to the necessity to. I mean, think about what we see now every day on the news about Haiti. You know, there's a need to encourage everybody, to encourage the survivors, to care for the widows and the orphans and the people that are beat up and in trouble. And the way you do that is kind of by exhorting them to remember the horrors of what happened. Similarly, the numbers, the historians that question the veracity of the numbers, are point out that if these are in fact the goals of these chronicles, so. Since we don't really know how many people there were. I mean, the people at the time didn't know how many Jews there were in their area. In other words, you might have known how many Jews there were in your shtetl or in your town or in your city. Or you might have had a fair guess. But you didn't know how many Jews there were in all of the Ukraine. You didn't know how many Jews there were in the whole of Poland. So if they erred on the side of inflating the numbers of the victims, it was with this good intention. It was with this good intention at heart. In 1652, there's a plague of cholera that sweeps the region. In Krakow alone, apparently thousands of Jews die from cholera. This often happens that a disease will come in the wake of war, when all of society is kind of broken down, and you know, after a number of years of the hell of the pogroms, and then the cholera, so a lot of Jews just kind of empty out. The survivors go other places, and there's a big rearrangement or big resettling of Eastern European Jewry. Maybe 20 or 30,000 Jews resettle, and they move into Russia, they move west, they move west into Germany, to Lithuania, the Balkans, etc. The significance of the destruction beyond the human toll is, of course, the destruction of communities, and we talked last time about the role that community played as the element which wove Jewish life together. The destruction of yeshivot, the destruction of batei din, the death of leadership of the communal leaders, of rabbis, of poskim, and all of this leads to a number of developments in Jewish religious and cultural life, which help create the modern Judaism that we know. So, for example, in the absence of spiritual and religious leadership, in the absence of yeshivot and batei din and rabbanim, there becomes a greater need for clarity and dissemination of halakha. So the debate around the value, it's funny for us to even think in these terms now, about the value of the Shulchan Aruch, is put to an end instantaneously. The Shulchan Aruch, the first volume of which is published in 1555, less than 100 years before. Like the Rambam in the 12th century, there's a debate about the value of having one unified code of law. Now, there's a pressing need for it throughout the largest segment of Jewish world population. The fact that this work, the Shulchan Aruch, was a hybrid work containing both the Sephardi Yosef Karo and the Ashkenazi Rav Moshe Isserles, who kind of acts not as a co-author, but as a running commentary, together with this pressing need to have clear, universal halakha, means that the Shulchan Aruch becomes even more so than what the Rambam was, even more so than the Mishneh Torah, becomes the definitive, final work of halakha. And it becomes the dividing line in terms of halachic literature between the Rishonim and the Achronim. And after the Shulchan Aruch, no posek can stand on his own two feet without either standing on the shoulders of the Shulchan Aruch, or if he disagrees with the Shulchan Aruch, having to contend with that. Because the Shulchan Aruch becomes the definitive post-Talmudic code. As a matter of fact, the two most significant commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, the Taz, the Turei Zahav by Rabbi David Halevi, and the Shach, the Sifsei Cohen by Rabbi Shabtai Cohen, were written, these two figures, the Shach and the Taz, themselves are survivors of the Gzerot Tach V'Tat. They're survivors of themselves, people themselves were victims of the persecution. Another impact of Gzerot Tach V'Tat in the mid-17th century is the wide dissemination of Kabbalat Ha'ari, of Lurianic mysticism. The Ari, or he's sometimes called the Arizal. If you ever come to visit us in Yerushalayim, our office, the Web Yeshiva office, is at the corner of Rehov HaNasi and Rehov HaAri, named after the Arizal. When I was a high school teacher of Jewish history, I kept a map of Yerushalayim on the wall of the classroom. And as we would talk about things, I would highlight the streets, you know, because virtually every name that we're talking about, except for the bad guys, there's no Khmelnytsky Street in Yerushalayim, but all the good guys, everybody has their own street. And over the course of the year, you could see as the map was, you know, turned to yellow as we highlighted the names of the streets. As we're going on, so there's a Rehov Ha'ari. The Ari was Ari. Is Ari means, of course, lion, but Ari is an acronym for Adonenu Rabbeinu Yitzchak Luria Zal, Zichrono Livracha. The Ari Zal, who lives from 1535 to 1572, a descendant of Jews who were exiled from Spain in 1492, he's residing for most of his life in Tzfat, and he develops a Kabbalistic mysticism. I mean, Kabbalah, of course, predates the Ari, but the Ari puts a new spin on it. It's more complicated than that, but I'm oversimplifying for the point of time. And those mystical doctrines, although he's long dead, he dies in 1572, but Lurianic Kabbalah, Kabbalat Ha'ari, which of course was expanded by his students. He had a group of followers and students, again, primarily here in Israel in Tzfat, although in other places as well. Lurianic Kabbalah and its mystical theology, its mystical doctrines, serve as a response to the horrors of Gzerot Tach V'Tat. And that body of ideas becomes a rich mine which is delved into, and those ideas begin to really spread following the pogroms of the mid 17th century. Now, this is very important because A, it highlights that traditional Jewish learning, what we sometimes think of as lumdus or Lithuanian learning or kind of conventional yeshiva learning, was not able to fully respond to the needs of the people that suffer these tragedies, and they turned to a more spiritual, mystical set of teachings because they find some response to their experiences there. There's something in the Kabbalah, in the mysticism, that resonates with what they've gone through. Kabbalah deals a lot with the topic of redemption, redemption as the natural end to persecution. These are themes that were just ready for the picking in the Kabbalah, and the dissemination of these teachings and this knowledge greased the wheels for Shabtai Tzvi. If you haven't heard of the Gzerot Tachvatat, I am guessing that you have heard of Shabtai Tzvi. There he is with his partner in crime, Natan Azati, Nathan of Gaza. Shabtai Tzvi was a false messiah. He was, depending upon how you interpret it, he was, at best a meshugana, and at worst a charlatan, and maybe a little bit of both. But the spread of, let's put it this way, the persecutions and the bad state that Eastern European Jewry was in following Gzerot Tachvatat, combined with the spread of the Kabbalistic ideas that fueled the fire of messianic speculation and a really heightened longing for redemption, opens the door for Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi is a very charismatic figure, but he's very, very odd. By the age of 22, he'd already had two failed marriages, apparently neither of which was consummated. He suffers from what seems like, again, this is anachronistic to talk in this way, but this is what the psychoanalytical school of history reads back into it. He suffers from some type of manic depressive psychosis. In 1648, the year of the persecutions begin, he begins to have messianic delusions. In 1651, he was excommunicated from Smyrna, where he lived, and he wanders around for 7 years, publicly violating various halachot, and doing so, claiming that either these halachot have been abrogated, that they no longer apply, or that his performing prohibitions is itself a redemptive act. In a seminal essay on this topic, the Jewish historian Gershom Shalom titled the essay. The essay in English is called "Redemption Through Sin," but in Hebrew, in the original Hebrew title, for those of you that learn Sukkah with us, I hope you'll catch the pun. The title of the essay is called "Mitzvah Haba'a Bi'Avera." If you catch the pun, then I feel gratified from the learning that we did when we learned Masechet Sukkah together, those of you that were with us. And if you don't catch the pun, I can explain it to you afterwards. This book by Gershom Shalom, Shabtai Tzvi, The Mystical Messiah. It's 1,000 page, literally 1,000 pages exactly, book about Shabtai Tzvi and the impact of the false messianic movement. Shabtai Tzvi is, of course, the second most significant false messiah in history. The first one, of course, being Jesus, who, after all, did have and still does have many followers and believers. Shabtai Tzvi is the second most significant false messianic movement in history. He was aided along the way. He was aided along the way by this character, this Nathan of Gaza, as he was called, who seems to be his, his Rasputin, you know, the guy pulling the strings from behind the curtains. He was called Nathan was called the prophet, and he claimed to be the prophet that prophesied the advent of Shabtai Tzvi, and perhaps he was actually the real visionary, the real force behind the whole movement. By 1665, Shabtai Tzvi has been openly proclaimed the Messiah. Rabbis are powerless to stop him because of the mass appeal. And there's a mass following of many thousands of Jews who believe that he is indeed the Messiah. And word spreads throughout the world, that the Messiah has come. He in 1666 he abolished Tisha B'Av as a fast day. He publicly eats non-kosher food and makes a bracha on the non-kosher food. Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, matir isurim, which is also, of course, a pun on our morning bracha of matir asurim, that God releases those that are bound up. He makes a play on words, matir isurim, that he has permitted that which is forbidden. This is, of course, similar to early Christianity, wherein there was a claim that the laws of the Old Testament, again using quotes, no longer apply. He declares that the 10 tribes will march on Yerushalayim and will free it from the Sultan's rule. At this time, Eretz Yisrael is controlled by the Turkish Sultan. Now, the Sultan in Turkey, in Istanbul, he's not too thrilled with this idea that you have this charismatic figure walking around telling everyone that we're going to go and we're going to conquer the land of Israel, which is, again, controlled by the Sultan at that time. So the Sultan gives him an option: either convert to Islam or die. And in fact, what happens is he converts to Islam. Now, this was, of course, shocking. And at that point, very many of the people that believed in him realized that they'd been fooled. But under Nathan's guidance and charisma and leadership, they develop a whole new doctrine. This doctrine, again, of redemption through sin, redemption through sin, that puts the whole idea of converting to Islam at the center of his ideas, and they develop a whole kind of counter religion, which is generally referred to as Sabbateanism, Shabtaut, followers of Shabtai Tzvi. And there are and were followers of Shabtai Tzvi, not so much anymore, although there are actually still some left in the world. But there were followers of Shabtai Tzvi for many generations following. The impact of all of this was a series of witch hunts, the most famous being between two rather well-known rabbis, Yaakov Emdin and Rav Yonatan Eibshitz, in which Rav Yaakov Emdin accused Rav Eibshitz of being a Sabbatian. And there were rabbonim, there were rabbis who initially either believed or were hopeful or were open to the idea that maybe this fellow could be the Mashiach. And of course, again, most people, most reasonable people, realized that they'd been had. But the whole thing weakens the image of the rabbinate at a time when it's most needed, when Jewish society is in disarray, and when in a couple of generations, even less, we'll be on the eve of the Haskalah, of the Enlightenment, which leads to the reform and the breakdown of traditional society. Another significant impact is the rise of Hasidut, which happens in the middle of the 18th century and which we will talk about next time. All of these events, the destruction and breakdown of Eastern European society, the inability of traditional modes of Jewish spirituality, synonymous generally with learning, with Talmud Torah, to kind of respond to the people's needs, the destruction and breakdown of rabbinic leadership, the spread of Kabbalistic ideas and the enmeshing of Kabbalistic ideas into Jewish life, the disappointment with the failure of this tragic messianic movement, which just, you know, set people up for an even bigger fall. All of these things then bring us to the figure of Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov, the innovator of Hasidut. And Hasidut, of course, is a mystical movement, even a redemptive movement. And one can see in it a response to, in many ways, a mirror image of what we see with Shabtai Tzvi, trying to address the people's needs, trying to lift them up in a way that will help reconstruct Jewish life and Jewish tradition and Jewish learning. So these are the events, like a series of dominoes from something not connected to us at all. Tensions between the Ukrainian Cossacks and the Polish ruling class sets in motion a series of events which in many ways leads to the Judaism that we have today, leads to modes of Avodat Hashem, of serving God, which we still have today. And even if I'm not Hasidic and you're not Hasidic, although some of us here are, but probably if you go back a generation or two, somebody's grandmother or somebody's grandfather, great-grandfather at least, was Hasidic. And even if not, even if you're a blue-blooded Litvak, we live in a world which has been influenced by all of these things, in the way that halakha develops, in the way that we, in the condition of modernity, which is opened by the Haskalah, by the arising of orthodoxy, or you know, orthodoxy, of course, is a new term. Once upon a time, you didn't need a term to describe the Orthodox because everybody was Orthodox. Everybody was Shomer Torah Umitzvot. Orthodoxy is a term which develops when one group has to identify itself in relation to the other, like Mitnagdim or Misnagdim, right? This once you have Hasidim, so the people who are not Hasidim, who are the way things always were, they're called the Misnagdim, the opponents of Hasidim, and they take on a term in opposition to this new group, even though they themselves have been around for... Really, it's the Hasidim who are the Mitnagdim. It's the Hasidim that are opponents to the way things have always been. But the status quo group becomes the Misnagdim, the opponents of this new group. And this is the world. These are some of the characteristics of the world in which we live. Khmelnytsky and Tach V'tat in 1648 and 1649 are both an echo of Churban HaBayit, of the destruction of the Jewish homeland in the beginning of the Common Era, in the year 70. And we see that in the motifs of Echa that run throughout works like the Yevin Metzula. But it's also a foreshadow of things to come. It's a foreshadow of what will happen in the beginning of the 20th century with the even greater destruction of European Jewry. So next time we'll start talking a little bit about Hasidut. I'll stay on the line if people have questions.